Accession number 8736, roll number 22.
Lord Harding, take 22. Could I ask you now, Lord Harding, about your time in England when you were sent back from Cairo to recover from your wounds?
Yes, well, I came back, I think it was in July. I was still in the hands of the doctors. And my wife and I went and stayed with her mother, my mother-in-law, a village called Long Ashton outside Bristol, and I used to go for attention to a naval hospital which was near there, who dressed my wounds and looked after me. And then it had been suggested that I should take over a sedentary job in the War Office from Sandy Galloway, who was an old friend of mine. I think he wanted to get out of the War Office, and he suggested to the authorities there that I should take over for him. He understood that I would be able to do that. And so, for some reason or other, and I don't know who was responsible, they said, no, we aren't going to agree to that. He's got to have another medical board before it is re-employed in any way. So I went up for another medical board. I suppose it must have been sometime that summer. And they checked me and put pins into me and that sort of thing. And they decided that my arm could be made much better. And so they recommended that I should go back to hospital, to the what was then called the Wingfield Morris Hospital at outside Oxford, for examination and treatment there. So that happened, and I went back there. It's a marvelous hospital. It's now called the Nuffield Orthopaedic Centre. And I was taken in hand by Tuweta and Seddon, who were the two leading surgeons there. And they decided to operate on my arm to try and get it more some use into it. And Seddon carried out the operation. It was a long one, and what they did was they relayed the nerve from my wrist up to my armpit. And in order to sort of bypass or compete with the breaks in my wrist, where the cells had hit my wrist. And so I was there, going in and out of hospital for some time, I suppose. And I gradually got better, and they gradually got movement back into my left hand, and I was getting on very well. And as I said, it was an excellent hospital. It was marvelous treatment, and my wife used to come up and stay in a hotel in Oxford, and I was allowed to go out in the afternoons, and we used to go around the various colleges visiting one college each afternoon, which was extremely interesting and a very happy time for me. And then I was getting really, you know, frustrated and anxious to get on and do something else again. And one day, Little Hart, the military writer and historian, came down to visit his son, who was in the Navy, who had also a nerve injury, who was a patient in the hospital. And he came along to see me. And he said, I knew him slightly, not well, but I knew him, and of course I knew a lot about him. And he said, was there anything you could do to help me? And I said, yes, you certainly can. You can tell the powers that be in London that I'm as fit and well as I can possibly be made, and perfectly fit to get back to the war again. And I don't know who he spoke to or what he did, but the upshot of that was that I was summoned for a further medical board at Millbank. And I went up to that, and then to my great relief and joy, they passed me fit for any duty suited to my rank and age and rank. I mean, it's clearly I couldn't have marched 10 miles carrying a full kit and that sort of thing, but I was physically able. By that time, I had been demoted from being a Major General to my permanent rank of Colonel, and so I came away from the medical board, and I went straight to the military secretary's office, which was then in Grosvenor Place somewhere, there, one of those big buildings there. And I asked the military secretary himself wasn't there, but I saw some brigadier, and told him that I had now been parts fit for any job, that I was suited to my age and rank, and what about it? And he looked up his books and he said, well, the only thing we've got vacant at the moment is as a divisional umpire. Would you be prepared to go as a senior umpire to one of the home divisions? And I said, yes, of course, if that's what you think I can best do, and that's my best contribution. Oh, I was a bit disappointed, of course, but I didn't. I said, oh, yes, of course I will. And then my wife and I went off to stay with some friends of hers up in Northumberland. And while I was there, this officer in the military secretary's department rang me up and said, I'd like to be the first to congratulate you on your new appointment of Commander 8th Corps. So, very childishly, I think, I said, well, that's a bit better than being a divisional umpire, isn't it? And of course, I was delighted. So I went up to Yorkshire and took over command of the 8th Corps, which was one of the Overlord Corps. It consisted of the 15th Scottish Division, the Guards Armoured Division, and another Armoured Division. And I was made myself very busy, you know, preparing for trying to get the training ready on lines that I thought were right for the great operation of Overlord. And I had for some time thought that really the most difficult and important thing is to learn how to live at war. And I think I've talked to you about this before. So I prepared an exercise, which meant that the whole of the corps would be out in the field for at least 10 days. And that was all being prepared and everything. And then, not having been at home for four years, I came down here to our house down here, which we'd recently acquired, for Christmas. And I think it was on Christmas Eve that pouring with rain in the evening, and a DR, we had no telephone, the DR arrived with a message for me, and I opened it, and it was from one of my staff in Yorkshire. And I thought it said that, when I read it first, I thought it said that he'd been ordered to go to Italy. And then I looked at it again, and I saw, no, it wasn't him, it was me, that I was to go to Italy. I was a bit taken aback, because I didn't know what it was all about. However, the following morning, the local popper, Bobby, came up, and said that the war officer rung him up and said that I was to ring up the CIDS as soon as possible. So I got on the telephone to Alan Brooke, Brookie as he was then, and he said, you better come up and see me. Alex wants you to go out to be chief of staff, you better come up and see me. So as soon as possible. So the next day I went up to London and I went along to the War Office and made my number with the CIDS, who told me that Alex, who was then commanding the army group in Italy, had asked for me to come and take over as chief of staff for him. And he made one rather cryptic remark at the time. He said, do you find Alex hadn't got a proper headquarters? And I didn't really understand what that meant. Anyway, better get off as soon as I can. So arrangements were made for me to fly from out to Algiers to start with, to meet the people at Allied Force headquarters there, and then go on and join up with Alexander. And so I think it was very early in the new year, the beginning of January, it may have been or the end of December, and I flew out, arrived at Algiers, and met Jock Whiteley, who I knew very well and had worked with in the Middle East, and talked to him, and it was then that he told me about the Operation Anzo, the landing at Anzo, the plan to land at Anzo. And I was a bit worried about that, and because I didn't know anything about combined operations. I'd had no experience of them at all, because I'd missed out the landing in Sicily, admittedly. So I was a bit worried about that. And then I was anxious to connect up with Alexander as soon as I possibly could and find out what was happening. So Al Gunter was there, who was Chief of Staff of the Fifth Army. And he said he was flying back to Italy and give me a lift to Naples, and then his aircraft could take me on to Taranto, where Alex's headquarters were. So I went with Al and got that was my first meeting with him, and I was very impressed by him, and gradually we got to know each other very, very well. Anyway, I arrived at Taranto and asked where the headquarters was and where the commander-in-chief, and they said, "Oh, the commander-in-chief's not here. He's gone to Tunis for a conference with Eisenhower." So I said, "Well, I better get on there straight away." And they said, "Well, you can't fly off tonight. You better." So I said, "Well, I'll take off at first light tomorrow morning." And the aircraft was available, and took an American aircraft. It took off next morning, first light, flew to Tunis, arrived there, and I asked the American officer on the airfield, "Where is General Eisenhower headquarters? Is he here? Is he here, I understand. Where is he?" He said, "Well, I think he's at a villa outside Tunis." I said, "Well, can you provide me with transport to get me there? Because I must connect up as soon as I can with Alexander, who I've just been appointed to told I'd go take over as his chief of staff." So he gave me a jeep, and we went to his villa. I arrived there and asked for where General Eisenhower and the others were, and he said, "Well, he'd just gone down the road for a meeting at the school." So I walked down, rushed down the road, and they'd just gone into the school. They're sitting down around the table, Eisenhower and Alexander and John Cunningham, who was naval commander-in-chief, and Mary Cunningham, who was, you call him Mary, it's Mary, that's why. He sort of came from New Zealand, and he's always known as Mary Cunningham. They're no relation. They were all sitting down around the table and had just started discussing the plans for the landing at Anzio. And I listened, and rather so, very anxious and concerned, because I didn't know much about what they were talking about, what LSTs and LCMs and all these landing craft names were completely Greek to me. Anyway, my first meeting with Eisenhower, and I was very interested, because at one stage of the meeting, Alexander and Cunningham, John Cunningham, the naval one, they were having a great argument, something to do with the arrangements for headquarters and communications or something like that, and they were really getting a bit hot under the collar. This happened, and the knight laughed. And that brought them to their senses. It was a master's joke. It was typical of him. And that they realized then that they were being childish and losing their heads and so on. And they came back. As a result of Ike's intervention by laughing, they calmed down, and they got down to talking, discussing the thing properly and rationally. And that was my first impression of Eisenhower. So at the end of the meeting, decided that we would continue to make plans for the opposition. I was very worried about it because I didn't think it was being launched in sufficient strength to be successful. However, as soon as we went back to Taranto. I flew back with Alexander to Taranto, and then I got to understand what Alan Brookham had meant when he said that Alex hadn't got a proper headquarters. So there was a smallish operational staff at Taranto with Alexander, and the administrative staff, or the whole of the logistic side of the operation, was being planned and would be conducted by Brown Robertson, who was then an offshoot of Allied Force Headquarters and was with a headquarters in Naples. And so there was no close link between the general staff and the administrative staff at all, except by long just a telephone across Italy. And so, this was a call to worry for me. And then we were told we were to go to Algiers and then on to Marrakesh for a meeting with the Prime Minister. Anyway, we went up. We took a short trip up to Oliver Leach, who was commanding the 8th Army, and discussed the problems with him. And then over to the other side, to Mark Clark, and had my first meeting with him. And then we flew off to Algiers. Well, and then with the meeting had discussions with Wilson and Ike's chief of staff, what's his name, something, Beadle Smith, who again impressed me very much as being an extremely capable and efficient staff officer. So that was my first meeting with him. And then we went on, we had that meeting there, and then we flew down to Marrakesh, where the Prime Minister was recovering from pneumonia, and had a series of meetings there, and discussing this anti-war operation. And the more I heard about it, and the further the discussion went, the more worried I became. Alexander had definitely committed himself to it, so there was no question of not carrying it out. It had been committed and accepted as part of the plan, the idea being to land south of Rome, but between the German lines, defensive position at Cassino and south of Rome at Anzio, and advance inland and cut the north-south-north route by which the main German forces from the Cassino area would withdraw. And anyway, the longer it went on, the more anxious I became.
Why were you so worried?
Because I didn't think the landing force was either strong enough or the follow-up was sufficient to make sure that the operation maintained, after original landing, maintained momentum and was able to drive its way against any possible German opposition and cut the main withdrawal routes for the German army coming back from Cassino. Also, I wasn't really happy about the possibility of breaking the Gustav line on the front. I mean, I was new to the whole thing, and it looked to me as being a difficult operation, and certainly I didn't think the plans for the landing were properly geared up or sufficiently strong. There weren't enough troops there. And my most vivid recollection of that meeting was when Admiral John Cunningham in one stage said to the Prime Minister, "You know, Prime Minister, this operation is fraught with great risks." Thereupon the Prime Minister turned on him and said, "Admiral, of course there is risk, but without risk there is no honour, no glory, no adventure." And whereupon Cunningham crumpled up because no admiral of the fleet could admit that he wasn't interested in honour, glory, or adventure. So that shut that up. But anyway, I came away, again, rather anxious and uncertain about the whole thing.
Were you able to voice your fears and worry? You know, were you
not
in a position?
Not then, no, but I did to Alexander. Well, not during that meeting. I just listened. I may have intervened once or twice to ask a question, but I didn't make any firm questions or any, you know, real questions of doubt or of plans. I thought I must wait and really go into it properly.
It sounds as if Churchill was very much behind the idea, though. Am I right in thinking that?
Oh, yes. I don't know whose original idea it was, whether it was his or whether it was whose it was. But anyway, it had been, the Prime Minister were very dead set on it. He thought it was going to lead to a big victory, because the German forces were driven back from Cassino, and their retreat was, at any rate, hindered, if not cut off altogether. It would be a big cop, he called it. And he was extremely interested and enthusiastic about the whole operation, and very anxious to make certain that it was a success, of course. So there we were. We went back to headquarters, and my first job, first thing I tried to do, was Alex was proposing to conduct this battle, that's the attack by the Fifth Army on the Cassino front and the landing at Anzio, from sort of tactical headquarters in a train at Caserta, north of Rome, by the Palace of Caserta. I didn't think this was much good, because it was going to be difficult, and it was an operation with a great deal of risk in it. And there was no administrative headquarters, or anyway, the administrative headquarters was down in Rome. So my first concern was to get a proper headquarters going. And the obvious place for it was Caserta, the Caserta Palace, which had been booked by Allied Force headquarters for their headquarters when they moved from Algiers to Italy, which they'd planned to do at some later stage. The only accommodation I could get from out of them, or any agreement I could get from them, was the top story of the Caserta Palace. So that was that, and I arranged to get that would enable me to keep in close touch with Brian Robertson on the administrative side. And Alexander, at that time, his orders, his directive was to continue the offensive in Italy in order to pin down as many German troops as possible. And to avoid them, to prevent them being removed from Italy to the Western Front. And that was his brief, and he was determined to carry that out in every way possible that he could. And this is what really determined his thinking. It overrode any other considerations in his thinking, that he must continue the offensive to pin down as many German troops as possible to prevent them being moved to the Western Front, because the Overlord was then reaching its starting point. It hadn't actually been launched. So he was determined to continue the offensive. Well, by that time, the Fifth Army had closed up to Cassino, and the Lurley Valley, the River Rapido, it was obvious that by then that the Germans were determined to hold that position, hold it firmly. It was a very strong position on the west coast that ran from the west coast through along what's the name of the river there? The Rocky Mountains, and then across the Rapido, the Leary Valley, with the Rapido, and then Monte Moschino, and then through the mountains across to the east coast. It was a strong and well-fortified position where the Germans had established themselves there firmly. And, of course, Monte Cassino was the key to it. And
what was so important about Monte Cassino?
Monte Cassino, well, the road forward, they'd already tried a limited offensive on the east coast, which had bogged down because of the succession of rivers and mountains and the difficulties of the country and so on. And the road forward was up the Leary Valley, which ran between Monte Cassino and the Urumqi Mountains towards the east coast, the west coast. And Monte Cassino, the feature itself and the defences on it, rarely dominated the Leary Valley. And it would be impossible, well, it would be extremely dangerous and risky to try and stage an advance up the Leary Valley with Monte Cassino still in the enemy's hands. So it was a critical point. And it was a critical feature of the Gustav line. And so if you wanted to, as Alexander did, according to these instructions, if you wanted to make the Germans continue to fight there, the place to attack them was at that critical point. And that explains why, in my view, that is what it was in his mind, the reasoning behind his repeated attacks against Monte Cassino, which at one time, in one of the final operations, nearly succeeded. The Gurkhas got nearly up to the monastery and then held on for some time and then eventually had to be withdrawn because they were in an impossible position and couldn't be supported. So that was that period of the period from I arrived back there in January, that carried us on until February, March, with those successive and unsuccessful attacks on Monte Cassino. And included, of course, the air bombardment of the monastery, which is, of course, had become a very highly controversial thing. And I held the view, and I think it was Alexander's reasoning at the time, that the troops believed that the Germans were holding the monastery, that it was a feature in their defensive position. And that's what they believed, and it was not unreasonable to think that, because there was no absolute clear evidence that they were in occupation of the monastery. But it was reasonable to think that they had, because it provided them with excellent observation, not only southwards, but right across the Leary Valley towards the Urumqi Mountains, which was the approach to Rome. Alexander, thinking was that the way to pin the Germans down was to attack them at their most critical point, and that's what he continued to do. And he went on, those attacks went on, one successively, only to about three or four separately planned attacks on Monte Cassino, all of which were unsuccessful, and then until the reserves had been exhausted, and the Fifth Army attempt to cross the Rapido, that failed too. It was very nearly successful, that failed. So there we were. We eventually, by the end of these attacks, we were stuck facing the Germans on the Gustav line.